Welcome to AMA Edgewise. I'm Dave Summers. AMA Edgewise is brought to you by the American Management Association. One of our most popular guests on Edgewise is Tim Sanders, author of Saving the World at Work, a book that offers concrete suggestions on how all of us can help our companies join the responsibility revolution. Tim talks about how the make a difference factor is revolutionizing brand building and how companies not paying attention to this change in marketing and mission branding are on the verge of obsolescence. Sanders offers practical advice every individual and company can use to make the world a better place now and in the future. Tim, welcome back to Edgewise.
I'm glad to be with you.
Tim, in your book, Saving the World at Work, you claim that when a company becomes a positive force for enriching people, communities, and the environment, not only does it save the world, but it saves the company from being irrelevant.
Yes. For most companies, or organizations for that matter, staying relevant means your brand is strong. You're someone that people want to do business with or work for. What I've experienced over the last decade of research is that when a company's brand gets sick, it loses its relevance and it loses its viability.
Right.
Examples abound. Oldsmobile, for example, lost a lot of its brand relevance. It certainly didn't stand for the cutting edge, and it doesn't exist as we know it as a result. The same happened to Greyhound bus lines. Tremendously high awareness of the brand, but not a very strong brand, and as a result, its viability has been in question, and numerous bankruptcies and reorganizations testify to that. So here's the idea. For decades and decades and decades, there's been this little cozy relationship in building your company's brand, and it basically went like this. If you were different and you delivered financial or product value, you survived and you thrived.
Mm-hmm.
And that party, as I see it, is over. Because people want something more than personal value and difference. What people want to do now is make a difference. And we're seeing a real trend from children to their grandparents, that people feel like the world is interdependent, and they've been taught this by a variety of current events. They're beginning to change the way they buy products, join groups, and even join companies. The groups and companies that don't synchronize with this will have a value proposition that is so 1990.
One of the things I'm hearing from you is that the make a difference factor is really going to be an attribute in brand building.
That's right. And for people out there that have studied brand, I apologize if this sounds elementary, but here's how I always thought about brand, and a lot of other people do too. There are different attributes, four of them, that build brand strength. Traditionally, the most important one, which really accounted for half of our brand strength, was differentiation. We held a special place in someone's mind that differentiated our brand from all the rest of the brands. That's half the battle. If you get that right, then you develop relevance. Your promise solves a problem that they have. And that's about maybe 20% of the battle. Definitely a tiebreaker if you're different. The third one, much less important traditionally, has been esteem, the company or the story behind a product or service. The fourth attribute was awareness. People know who you are, something usually the most important at the beginning and the end of a product or a company life cycle. But the world has changed, and the ad agencies that I work with have been noticing that esteem, traditionally the weakest of the attributes, on a percentage level has grown in brand strength determination more than computing power since 2002. What I mean by this is that making a difference is the new difference.
Are there any companies you feel are in danger of becoming obsolete and or irrelevant, and why?
I don't know why I'd name them, but I'd be happy to describe them.
Okay.
I believe that any company can turn around. I saw Interface Floor, a very, very important carpet company out of Atlanta, do a massive turnaround in maybe a year and a half from 1994 to almost 1996 because the CEO had a vision. So it can be done.
For instance?
Let me tell you the type of company that's in trouble. Three kinds of companies. Let's call the first one just for profit. A company whose mission statement continues to be serve the shareholders will find themselves alienating the stakeholders over the next decade. Who are the stakeholders? They're anybody that can affect or is affected by the company. These stakeholders include employees, suppliers, host communities, and the environment, as well as stakeholder groups like NGOs, etc. Companies that only serve shareholders will find themselves subject to being surprised in the market, like Mohawk and Milliken in 1998 and 1999 when Interface Floor's new value proposition of ecologically sound carpet and recycling caused them to have to reorganize overnight with the public breathing down their neck, paying consultants far too much to catch up. And they never really did catch up.
Mm-hmm.
We're seeing this in Detroit. I have been predicting for 5 years that Ford and GM, who some argue killed the electric car at the request of oil companies like ExxonMobil, would eventually scramble to quickly get hybrids to market once Prius reached the tipping point and then gas prices went up, which was exactly what Toyota saw coming as far back as 1994. And it's happening. Up till 2006, 85% of all of Detroit's profits came from SUVs and heavy trucks. Now that those have become the new mink coats of society, they've got to play catch-up. It's not cheap, and they never will really catch up, at least not in this generation of business as we know it. I hope that we all look at companies like that and say, we'd better not get Priused in the future. And that's just the environmental picture.
Tim, I keep seeing articles and books on innovation, and in the business community, there's a great deal of attention to innovation. To what extent is saving the world going to influence the innovation movement?
The example I talk about in the book that I think is relevant to this conversation is Green Mountain Coffee Roasters, a popular company that makes sustainable and fair trade certified coffee. Don Ostler is a fleet manager for about 48 drivers who man 24 trucks. Doesn't sound like an earth-changing job, but hear this story. His company has a sustainability initiative to dramatically reduce its carbon footprint and cut its costs at the same time, which most companies are thinking about because of the recession. He innovated, meaning he said, what's the problem? The problem is we're using far too much gas and our footprint for the delivery fleet is too high. And it's not like we can go get hybrid trucks tomorrow. This isn't the environment for that. So he had to innovate to meet a mandate to reduce the footprint of his group by as much as 20%. And what he did was typically what innovators do. He listened, he researched, he scrutinized, and then when he found the solution, he evangelized. What he found out was that 30% of all the gas that his drivers used was idling, where they're making a 20-minute delivery and they leave the truck running. When he engaged the group and said, why do you do it, which is what a good eco-innovator does, or any innovator does, in other words, you go say, why do we do this legacy procedure? The answer was, common knowledge, it'll get too hot or cold in the truck. Or, it's going to wear off the starter on the truck to turn it on and off all day. So he did a study. He took a certain number of trucks and a certain number of drivers and had them turn the engine off when they made deliveries and then studied climate control and engine wear. He found out very quickly that climate control was not an issue and that engine wear was actually increased because of idling and that you could turn a starter off and on 20,000 times before it would need to be replaced. So he kept on in his program evangelizing that, and eventually he reached a tipping point and the drivers all got involved and they cut the fleet usage of gasoline by 20% in the second year. They even made up shirts for the truck drivers to wear that said, I saved the planet 5,000 gallons of gasoline with idle reduction. And the joke now at Green Mountain is that the drivers are so on board with this innovative idea that they've been known to turn their engine off when they're at a long stoplight. So innovation has three components. Problem identification, what's broken, or what does the customer want that we don't have? What does the market want that doesn't exist? Step two is ideation. What are new ways of doing it? And step three is execution. Or as Harvard professor Henry Chesebrough likes to say, innovation is when a solution successfully makes it to market. What's going on right now with social responsibility programming, sustainability programming that helps a company reduce its dependence on carbon products, and how it affects a company's reputation to customers and employees? I think all these things are really big problems for companies based on their legacy procedures, and that they're going to have to innovate their way out of this.
Could you tell our listeners what industries are in danger and need to do something now?
There's two industries that are in danger. The first is industries that have a negative footprint, either on employees, the communities where they do business, or the planet. That's the first group I want to talk about. I am a huge student of the quality movement as led by Japanese manufacturers. It started with the work of expat Americans like Deming and Juran and Crosby. They taught the Japanese that quality was free, that quality control had to be built into the system. The managers didn't manage components, they managed the system for quality.
Exactly.
And what happened was the quality revolution started in the most inefficient industries where quality was at its lowest. So it started out in electronics and appliances, and it spread to cars. Those industries that didn't get it lost tremendous market share, and companies like Motorola had to reinvent themselves and come up with something called Six Sigma to survive this. They were chased out of the low handset market and almost at risk of being chased out of the market by competitors who could sell a product to a customer cheaper than they could make it. And this happened to a lot of companies like Xerox.
Very interesting.
That's what Ray Anderson saw at Interface. The carpet industry was one of the dirtiest industries to the environment every step of the way. It used petroleum to make its product, and then the product ended up in a landfill where it took 23 years to break down into methane. And he realized that if he didn't fix it, the customers would by selecting companies that had the innovations. So when he turned around the carpet industry, it became the only American industry to this day that meets the Kyoto Protocol, which is amazing.
Absolutely.
So the first answer is, if your industry has a heavy footprint on people, community, or planet, you better watch out, because there's an Aveda Corporation coming. If you're in the personal care products, there's an Interface coming, there's a Timberland coming, there's going to be a Google coming in your market. There's going to be people that do it greener than you or have a cleaner impact.
Right, right.
Here's a second group. The late majority, this is going to happen so fast when sustainability hits your industry, you won't have time to react to it. So again, let me go back to quality. The quality movement was mostly a manufacturing thing, probably for the first few decades. When quality came to the electronics business, it started with the Tokyo Olympics. I believe that was 68. It was the defining moment where Japan showed off its prowess in electronics. And between 68 and about 1980, it was a revolution. It took 12 years, but all of a sudden, American electronics industries had to go quality or die. It took 12 years, but it spread. Because once quality was free and once quality became a business proposition, they wanted it in everything. And when it jumped the pond into services and government, it picked up speed like a hurricane. So in 1987, when the quality movement came to the healthcare business, it didn't take 12 years, it took 2 years. And the consultants weren't cheap. They were booked already with the manufacturers, and certain healthcare organizations did not make it because they couldn't react quick enough. What should they have been doing? They should have been thinking out of the box, benchmarking manufacturing since 1970, like Kaiser did, and making changes anticipating that this disease would come to them. And this is my point. If you're a law firm, or you're a services organization, or you're a government organization, you'd better just plan on CSR and green infecting you and your industry in the next 5 to 10 years, and you're either going to be ahead of the curve and driving it, are behind the curve of a very fast-moving hurricane trying to figure out why you didn't get it. So those are the two types of companies I'm the most concerned about.
What about the people who say, this isn't the time to be thinking about the environment? We're suffering from an economic downturn. Should the responsibility revolution be a key factor right now?
The idea here is that it costs money. This is just like the quality revolution all over. This is exactly what people said in 1973 around the oil embargo and the following recession. It's not the time to go quality. These are the same companies that had wholesale layoffs by 1980 when they missed it. Here's the issue, and this is what Duran would say, or even Philip Crosby. Quality was always free if you did it right. When Interface went green, they saved $300 million in the first 3 years. I believe that efficiency and waste elimination, which is the heart and soul of the ECO program, is free. It's a recession-friendly strategy. So when a company says, I want to save the world at work, there's two ways you go about it. The recession strategy is to reduce your impact and reduce your waste. So all the things we're doing right now, for example, waste elimination of everything from document printing to travel, these are net-net money makers, and you should totally be obsessing about those now. When the economy gets better, you're going to start the other kind of responsibility, and that is the investment strategy for boom times. That would be things like replacing non-sustainable ingredients with sustainable ingredients, changing from non-organic to organic, from non-recycled to recycled, from petroleum-based product to post-consumer-based. All of those are expensive, and this may not be the time to do those, but this is certainly not the time to ignore the environment.
Right.
So it's really a question of innovation again. There are a lot of companies today that are building a beachhead while the stock market is bad anyway. And they're going to exercise this just like the companies in my book did around the dot-com crash. Most of today's innovators, like Toyota, for example, made all their double-down investments on the Prius as the market crashed and saw dividends when the market came back in 04 and 05 and 06.
Tim, I want to wrap this up with just, is there anything you want to share with us related to this book that you feel, just in general, people aren't aware of or should be made aware of?
Yes, and this is more of an ethical issue. Horst Reschelbacher, founder of Aveda, we should have his viewpoint that companies report to the planet, that any company or any organization is a wholly owned subsidiary of the planet. And if you don't believe it, just imagine that the planet no longer was hospitable to humans and no longer provided natural resources like oxygen or water. What would the business environment be like? Here's the way I explain it. Think of Earth as a startup. It's been given all the rounds of funding it's going to receive, and it's got to make it. And right now, this startup is spending more money than it makes. In business terms, we call it a burn rate.
Oh, yes.
What do you do when you're at a startup, you've got a burn rate going, and you're going to run out of cash and die? You do less. You find a way to reduce the burn rate so that your business development team, the innovators, can find new products, new services, and new marketing campaigns to get more financing. This is how I see the environment issue. The earth is on fire. We're on a burn rate. And every company that isn't efficient is participating in and increasing the burn rate. So the trick now is to convince our employees to help stop the bleeding, to give time for everything to fall in place and the innovations to come to market so that we can make a difference. And this applies to communities and people as well.
In your book, you refer to these individuals as savior soldiers.
That's right.
And savior CEOs.
Yes.
Do you have a website where people can visit?
It's savingtheworld.net. Savingtheworld.net is a new type of technology. It's called the knowledge networking site. And what the site does is, I want you to think of it like Facebook meets businesssocialresponsibility.org. It's a member-generated blog where people just like you and me can talk about our innovations and, using social networking technology, find other people in our industry that have already solved these problems so they can share knowledge with us.
We've been speaking to Tim Sanders, author of the book Saving the World at Work. Tim, thanks for being with us today.
Absolutely, Dave. My pleasure.
Just remember, we really need your feedback. So please drop us an email at podcast@amanet.org. Or call us at 800-697-3406. That number again is 800-697-3406. Thanks for taking us along. I'm Dave Summers, and you've been listening to AMA's Edgewise.